Hello. My name is Winnie Chow, and I'll be introducing our next speaker, Dr. Vandergriff. He practices in dermatology and dermatopathology at UT Southwestern Medical Center, Department of Dermatology. He graduated summa cum laude from the University of Texas at Austin, where he majored in Plan 2 Honors, Linguistics, and Spanish Literature. He later graduated from Baylor College of Medicine with highest honors. Dr. Vandergriff completed his dermatology residency and dermatopathology fellowship at UT Southwestern. He is currently Associate Professor of Dermatology and Pathology, Director of Dermatopathology, Associated Program Director of Dermatology Residency, and the Robert G. Freeman, MD, and Clay J. Cockrell, MD Chair in Dermatopathology. He is interested in skin cancer, inflammatory skin diseases, and medical education. And let's all welcome him on stage.
Thank you, Winnie, for the introduction. And thanks to the SDPA for inviting me to participate in this conference. I'm going to be talking this afternoon a little bit more about Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So this is a diagnosis that we heard some about this morning from Dr. Bologna from an excellent presentation. I'm going to expand a little bit on not just making the diagnosis, but what to do when you've suspected the diagnosis of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and then also expand a little bit on some of those related diagnoses that can look like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or act like Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And I'll check in periodically to see if there's questions. If y'all have questions in the presentation and you want to come up to the microphone and just shout them out, that's fine. I'll also try to save a little bit of time at the end to answer questions. So the first thing when we're talking about Stevens-Johnson syndrome is to really understand some of the terminology that's used when we're talking about blistering mucocutaneous eruptions due to infections or drugs. So nosology basically just means the names and the terminology we use to describe the various diagnoses that represent skin and mucosal eruptions, which are usually due to infection or drug. And why would an infection or a drug conspire to create an eruption in the skin or the mucosa? And it's due to the immune response. So infections trigger your immune system to react. Drugs can also activate the immune system as a response to an antigen. And so both of these can initiate the pathway, and those pathways converge on the clinical presentations that we're going to talk about. So on one kind of milder end of the spectrum is a diagnosis that we may be familiar with in the clinical setting, which is erythema multiforme. So erythema multiforme is usually due to an infection. So herpes simplex virus being the most common, also potentially caused by mycoplasma and some of the other respiratory viruses can cause erythema multiforme. It's less common for erythema multiforme to be caused by a drug. We're going to look at some photographs of the primary lesions in a second, but erythema multiforme is the prototype diagnosis for this targetoid papule. Whenever I think about a skin eruption and describing it and developing a differential diagnosis, to me, the most important thing is to really start with an observation of, okay, what is our primary lesion in the skin? That's how you classify your diseases into categories. So, for example, you've heard of categories like papulosquamous. That means that the primary lesion is a scaly papular plaque. Vesiculobullous, that means the primary lesion is a blister. So that's how you put the disease into a category and work through a shorter differential diagnosis. In erythema multiforme, the primary lesion is a targetoid papule. So targets or targetoid papules. Now, depending on the course of the disease, those papules can vesiculate or blister. There's going to be very little detachment, though. So very little of the epidermis will become detached or eroded. And this is a big point of distinction with some of the more severe variants like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or toxic epidermal necrolysis. So, and we'll look at photographs of all of this in just a second. Another very important factor when you're considering your differential diagnoses is to think about the distribution of the eruption. So what parts of the body are involved? In an erythema multiforme, the classic distribution is this acral distribution. So hands and feet, specifically the volar aspect, palms and soles. Erythema multiforme also affects the face. So you can see targetoid papules on the face. They may have mucositis. So mucositis is an analogous term to dermatitis. Dermatitis is sort of this non-specific description of inflammation in the skin. So we use dermatitis as a term in a lot of specific diagnoses like atopic dermatitis or nummular dermatitis. But dermatitis itself is not a very specific word. Mucositis is just the analogous term meaning inflammation on your mucosa. So in the eye, in the mouth, or in the anogenital area. So if we're talking about mucositis, that means that one of those surfaces is involved by inflammation. And usually, it's hemorrhagic. So you'll see crusting and bleeding and scabbing on these surfaces. Okay, so these are the targets of erythema multiforme. This is a palm, which is the classic distribution. And the lesions have this targetoid appearance, and it's a three-zoned target. So there's three zones to a target. This is called a typical target, and we'll look a little bit later at what it would constitute an atypical target. But a typical target has three zones. In the middle of the target has a dusky center. So you'll notice that the center of the target is a little bit darker. Peripheral to that, you've got some pallor. It's a little bit more pale. It's also edematous in this area, which makes it raised. That's why we're calling these targetoid papules, not macules. And then beyond that, at the peripheral border, you have an erythematous rim. So these are the three colors to see. You'll see dark in the center, dusky red, then a more pale pink, raised rim outside of that, and then peripheral to that, a red flat border. That's the typical target of erythema multiforme. We're going to expect to see those on acral skin, palms and soles. Erythema multiforme, I mentioned earlier, affects the face. When it affects the face, it's usually mucosal. And patients with erythema multiforme can have mucositis. They'll have hemorrhagic erosions. They can have crusting. Now, it's not a requirement for the diagnosis. The targetoid papule is really the primary lesion. So we always want to inspect the mouth, you want to inspect the eyes, and then the anogenital skin when you're considering the possibility of erythema multiforme and look for mucositis. It's not a requirement, but it is, it's often present. As an aside about mucositis, this is a really important clinical sign to be looking for when we're talking about drug eruptions. We'll talk about Stevens-Johnson syndrome more in a second, which is usually a drug eruption, but the whole conundrum with drug eruptions is trying to decide, is this a serious one or is this not so serious? Is this something that I can manage with some topical steroids as an outpatient, or is this something where the patient needs to be hospitalized? And probably the best clinical indicator of a serious drug eruption is mucositis. So the patient has mucosal erosions on the lips, the eyes, or the anogenital. That's an indicator of a serious drug eruption like Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And when they're on the lips like this, it's hard to miss. I think that we would all notice this immediately when examining a patient. Eyes also. You know, it's going to be something that stands out to you if the eyes are red, inflamed, or even crusted on the eyelids. Anogenital is a little bit more tricky because you either have to inspect or rely on the patient to report the mucositis. So that's one. If you're thinking about Stevens-Johnson syndrome or erythema multiforme and you're not seeing any mucosal erosions on the face, definitely check the anogenital skin and check to see if there's involvement in those areas. So looking a little bit more at the nosology of blistering eruptions, I mentioned earlier due to infection or drug. So infections that cause erythema multiforme, usually herpes simplex virus or mycoplasma. We're learning now that respiratory viruses can also lead to a similar eruption that resembles erythema multiforme. And you're gonna see this appearing in the literature under different names. And it's just now getting enough traction to start appearing in textbooks. So this is kind of so new that it may not be in your textbooks yet, but it's just now entering into the lexicon in dermatology. And the original term that was used for this is called MIRM, mycoplasma-induced rash and mucositis. And it's now being called RIME, R-I-M-E, which is respiratory infectious mucositis and mucocutaneous eruption, RIME, R-I-M-E. And the point of that kind of tweak in the name is to recognize that, hey, it's not always mycoplasma. It can be other stuff like coronaviruses or enteroviruses or some of these banal respiratory viruses, and they can trigger your immune system to react in a way that the skin becomes inflamed and the mucosa becomes inflamed. And it looks a lot like erythema multiforme. This particular presentation, MIRM, what I'm gonna call MIRM, but know that the causative agents include other respiratory viruses, is more common in children than adults. And the reason it kind of emerged as a separate entity from erythema multiforme is because they have terrible, terrible mucositis, and yet not that much skin involvement. Maybe a few papules, maybe a few targets, but their skin looks pretty good, but the mouth, the eyes, and the anogenital, terribly eroded and crusted. And so it was sort of like in erythema multiforme, we expect to see more skin stuff, papules, targets, with a little bit of mucosal involvement. It's the reverse scenario in MIRM. More common in children, and it presents with severe mucositis, oral being the most common, then followed by ocular, and then the urogenital tract being the least commonly, but potentially affected. The cutaneous involvement in MIRM is limited. It may even be absent, so you may just see the mucositis. The kids are gonna present with mouth pain, they're not gonna wanna swallow, they may not wanna talk, and you'll see that hemorrhagic crust on the lips. It looks terrible. It tends to follow a more benign course than erythema multiforme or Stevens-Johnson syndrome would, even though it has this really dramatic clinical appearance. It can result in long-term complications, especially if the eye is involved. So this is a scenario, if you're suspecting MIRM, where there's mucosal erosion, you definitely want to have an ophthalmologist examine the patient to look to see if the eye is involved, and it may require treatment by the ophthalmologist, including eye drops or potentially even amniotic membranes that they transfer to the eye, and that's to prevent corneal scarring. Most of the time, though, MIRM requires only supportive care. So respiratory viruses also have been identified, and one way to test for that is a panel of respiratory viruses. It's a nasal swab, and you can order that, and it can identify if the patient has a respiratory virus. These are some examples that were published in the original description of MIRM. And notice that the photographs really show more predominant inflammation of mucosal epithelium. So we've got the eyes here involved, they're erythematous, there's some hemorrhage on the sclera. The mouth showing erosions, crusting, hemorrhages, and then very little in the way of skin involvement. There are papules and there are some targetoid lesions, but it doesn't have the acral predominance that erythema multiforme does. So very little skin involvement in MIRM. Okay, so moving on to other entities under this umbrella of mucocutaneous eruptions due to infection or drug. The two that we just talked about, erythema multiforme and MIRM, are more associated with infection, HSV, mycoplasma, and respiratory virus. Now, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, on the other hand, is more of a drug eruption. And consequently, this is something that we think of a little bit more commonly in adults. They take more medications than kids do. certainly Stevens-Johnson syndrome can affect kids, especially if they've been treated with an antibiotic, but a little bit more common in adults than erythema multiforme and MIRM are. Stevens-Johnson syndrome presents with a prodrome. So this is kind of an important part of the history. You know, when we think about drug eruptions, like I said earlier, one of the most important goals that you would have is deciding, is this a serious drug eruption, or is this something that can be managed in the outpatient setting and is not really, life-threatening? And getting the clinical history of the prodrome is an important factor in making that decision. So a benign drug eruption, like a morbilliform drug eruption, has no, doesn't register with the patient as having any kind of prodrome symptoms. They don't feel bad. They don't have fevers. And most importantly, they don't have skin pain. So this is the most important clinical history that you can ask about when you're thinking about drug eruptions, is what does the skin feel like? I mentioned earlier that when you're looking at the patient and you're trying to decide, is this bad or not bad, look at the mucosal epithelium and check for mucositis. That's a sign. We're talking now about the symptom that you ask the patient about, and the most important thing to ask is, what does the skin feel like? And I usually present that as an open-ended question. What does your skin feel like? I don't want to necessarily put words in their mouth, but I'm trying to get a sense, and the two options are itch or pain. Maybe there's no symptom at all, in which case that I'm okay with that, but I want to know, does this itch or does this hurt? And I'm not going to lead with the options. I usually ask the patient open-ended, you know, what does your skin feel like? If they say, you know, no, it feels okay or like nothing, I'll say, does it itch, does it hurt, or neither, and present those options. If you get a response that it hurts, especially if the patient tells you it feels like a sunburn, that's sort of like the classic response is sunburn. It doesn't have to be like, you know, painful. It can even be just kind of a light sting, and that's why the sunburn analogy often comes up. That is a huge red flag, and it's part of the prodrome. So Dr. Bologna mentioned earlier today that Stevens-Johnson syndrome presents in its earliest stage as a morbilliform eruption. And that basically just means that the primary lesion is a pink papule. Super nonspecific. I mean, we see those kind of eruptions a lot, and it's like, okay, is this something that's bad? How we're seeing it at a moment in time, and what we're concerned about is, how is it going to evolve? What's it going to look like tomorrow? What's it going to look like a week from now? And if you get the history that there's skin pain, that's a warning sign that this is going to evolve into something serious. The primary lesion of Stevens-Johnson syndrome is a targetoid macule, so a little bit different than what you see in erythema multiforme. So I described the typical targets as having three zones of color and that raised middle ring. In Stevens-Johnson syndrome, they're really more flat, a little bit duskier, and they're usually just two colors. So we call those atypical targets, and we'll look at some pictures of that in a second. Stevens-Johnson syndrome, by definition, will have less than 10% body surface area involvement. And it's important to know that with that percentage, we're talking about epidermal detachment. It's blistering. It's not how much of their body is red, it's how much has detached. And it's got to be less than 10% to classify it as Stevens-Johnson syndrome. If it's over 10%, we go up into other categories, more severe categories, which we'll talk about in a sec. Stevens-Johnson syndrome tends to have severe mucositis, often clinically obvious, but again, you would want to check anogenital skin. This, in contrast to erythema multiforme, is more often caused by drugs. And we know the common culprits include allopurinol, anti-epileptics like carbamazepine and lamotrigine and phenytoin. Those are probably the biggest ones. And then antibacterial drugs like Bactrim. Some of the penicillin-related drugs, and NSAIDs. And then those are going to be the main causes. If you look up case reports of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, you're going to find a list that's super long. So don't discount other drugs as potential causes. Most drugs initiate Stevens-Johnson syndrome, were started 7 to 10 days prior. So the time frame is usually 7 to 10 days before the onset of the prodrome and the macular eruption. Rarely Stevens-Johnson syndrome can be caused by mycoplasma, more often a drug induced. It's pretty rare, 2 to 7 million cases per year. I practice at UT Southwestern, and we have a burn referral center at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. And so these patients are often referred, and so we see quite a bit more than that. So it seems more common in that setting, but out in the community, it's really not very common. It's 2 to 7 million per year, but something you don't want to miss, and something that oftentimes is always on our mind as a worst case scenario. Stevens-Johnson syndrome is more common in patients with HIV and with cancer, and the mortality can be high. At 6 weeks, mortality is 12%. So these are some of the lesions of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. We've got targets. Notice that they're flat and two-colored. So they are round, they've got a dusky center and an erythematous border. There's blisters, which is where the epidermis has detached and lifted off, creating a blister. That detached epidermis is dead, devitalized skin. And when it falls off, you get the blistering. The devitalized skin that is the surface of a blister has a dusky appearance. So when you see a dusky, dark red color to the skin, that implies that that epidermis is undergoing necrosis or dying. It's becoming devitalized and will eventually detach. And then finally, we get this secondary change called erosion. And erosion is a partial thickness defect in the epidermis, and it represents detachment and loss of that epidermal surface. It's kind of a later stage of the lesion. And again, that would be the detachment is what you're measuring the percent or estimating the percentage in for your classifications. And in Stevens-Johnson syndrome, should be less than 10%. Okay, so mucositis I mentioned as a major factor and parameter in Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And again, we're seeing pictures here of the mouth, hemorrhagic. It's crusted, it has kind of a scabby appearance, and this is incredibly painful. So the patients are not going to want to swallow, they're not going to want to talk. It can lead to dehydration because of the reluctance to swallow. So what's the next kind of bump up on the severity spectrum? We call that toxic epidermal necrolysis. And toxic epidermal necrolysis and Stevens-Johnson syndrome are basically like severity variants of one another. And ultimately defining how severe it is requires some knowledge of the way that the eruption develops over time. So to say that I'm seeing the patient in one moment and I'm counting the percent of surface area around 8%, and I'm saying, okay, this is Stevens-Johnson syndrome, doesn't mean that, you know, 2 days from now, we don't have more detachment and we reclassify as TEN, toxic epidermal necrolysis. So it can evolve over time, and you can reclassify. But toxic epidermal necrolysis, again, has the prodrome, starts out with fever, malaise, and skin pain. It tends to be a little bit more abrupt onset. So Stevens-Johnson syndrome, Dr. Bologna presented this awesome analogy of extra crispy chicken, and it's like a drug eruption, but just with those extra symptoms that make it more severe. And it demonstrates that evolution. Toxic epidermal necrolysis can really be an abrupt eruption. And patients, again, will present with these dusky targetoid macules and erythematous patches, but we're talking about more than 30% body surface area. So these patients are going to have a lot of detachment. It's that detachment that creates the risk for infection. And patients with TEN, when they die, it's usually from an infection. And that's why the amount of detachment really upgrades the risk here and the mortality. Stevens-Johnson syndrome and toxic epidermal necrolysis affect the trunk, face, and extremities, with TEN showing more confluence. Both will have severe mucositis. TEN is drug-induced. I would not think of infections really as a potential cause here, mostly drugs, and it's the same drugs that we attribute to Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So allopurinol being a big one, the antiepileptics, and antibiotics and NSAIDs. And again, it's of that 7 to 10 day time frame. The incidence is about 2 per million per year, and again, HIV and cancer can be predisposing factors. Mortality here at 6 weeks is almost 50%, so really a severe eruption and life-threatening. The mortality is, like I said, related to infection as being the main risk, and that's due to this extensive detachment. So the pictures that we're looking at here, this is the arm. This patient is in the hospital. You can see the EKG leads and the IV tubing. And the epidermis here has totally fluffed or detached and become devitalized. So full background of erythema. This is an erosion here where the epidermis has detached. And all of this kind of like crumpled up epidermis is dead necrotic epidermis. All of this here that's still on the surface is very fragile. And if you go apply a little bit of lateral traction to that with your finger, it will slide right off. And that's called the Nikolsky sign. You may have heard of Nikolsky's sign in pemphigus and helping distinguish pemphigus from bullous pemphigoid. It's also present in TEN and SJS. It's when you apply a little bit of lateral traction on the epidermis, it's just so fragile that it will slide right off. I don't usually do that test because you don't want to extend the blisters and make them bigger, but that's historically something that has been described in TEN. So I always think of Stevens-Johnson syndrome and toxic epidermal necrolysis as severity variants. And historical, the old school term for this overarching umbrella, it was called epidermal necrolysis. And this photograph here is from Dr. Bologna's textbook, and it just shows the extent and the distribution of this overlap syndrome. So Stevens-Johnson syndrome being on the left side of the screen here and showing that kind of widespread eruption, less confluence, so more single papules but less confluence. This TEN showing more confluence and more detachment. So at least 30% epidermal detachment to classify as TEN, less than 10% to classify as SJS. And if you're in between, if you're 10 to 20%, we call that SJS-TEN overlap. So that's kind of how we get to the classification is based on degree of detachment. So what happens with SJS and TEN? Why is this developing? It's basically due to the impaired ability to detoxify drug metabolites. So your liver is the organ that functions to detoxify drugs and eliminate them from our system. When they begin their metabolism, there are intermediate metabolites that sometimes the liver cannot further metabolize into something that can be secreted. Those intermediate metabolites can be toxic. And if we're not able to detoxify them, they can exert toxic effects. Not always on the skin, sometimes it's the kidney, for example, but in the case of SJS or TEN, it is the skin. And certain drugs are more susceptible to this intermediate formation and inability to detoxify. I mentioned allopurinol. The antiepileptics, it's mostly the older school, old generation drugs like carbamazepine, phenytoin, but lamotrigine is a big one. So lamotrigine or Lamictal actually comes with a black box warning for SJS and TEN, and it is dosed in a way that is escalated. So it's begun at low doses and then titrated up, and that helps reduce the risk of developing TEN, but the risk is super high in lamotrigine. Then some of your penicillin antibiotics, the sulfa drugs, and then some of the NSAIDs, not all of them, but the oxycam family of NSAIDs are high risk for SJS or TEN. It's usually in the first 8 weeks of treatment. Classic is 7 to 10 days after you begin treatment, but outside of 2 months, the risk is reduced significantly. So if somebody's been on Dilantin, for example, for 10 years, that's probably not the cause of their SJS or TEN. We know that there are certain genotypes or genetic signatures which confer susceptibility to SJS or TEN. Why is this important? You can actually test for these genes to determine who's susceptible and do it as a pre-prescribing test. So patients that are gonna get carbamazepine, for example, it's indicated to check in certain populations, especially Asian populations, check for this HLA variant called B1502. That variant is prevalent in 7 to 10% of Asian patients. And if you have that variant, you cannot metabolize the carbamazepine appropriately and you are at risk for SJS or TEN. So before prescribing, neurologists will check for that. Similar situation with this abacavir, which is a drug for treating HIV. The infectious disease doctors check for this HLA before prescribing. So there are certain ways in certain populations to try to reduce the risk or identify high-risk patients before prescribing. What actually is happening at the level of the skin is an immunology process. So it's the immune system that is inappropriately targeting the skin. And these are CD8 positive T cells. These T cells are supposed to be, they're called cytotoxic T cells. They're supposed to be killing cells that have become infected or cells that have cancer antigens on them, but they are inappropriately killing your normal keratinocytes. The reason that they're doing that is they're being told to do that by cytokines. The cytokines are released in response to these drugs. Apoptosis means programmed cell death. It basically is when a keratinocyte induces its own death, and it's triggered by these cytokines and these ligands that that have been identified in Stevens-Johnson syndrome and TEN, and interleukin-15 being one of the kind of the more recently described drugs. Interleukin-15, for example, will trigger all kinds of inflammatory reactions from your lymphocytes and all the different inflammatory cells in the skin. So it's really a cascade of inflammation in the skin that leads to this keratinocyte or epidermal cell death. If you do a biopsy of TEN, this is what you see. So I love looking at these biopsies and thinking about how does this correlate with the clinical. I'm going to be doing a lecture later, I think maybe tomorrow, on DermPath 101. Super interesting to correlate path and clinical findings, and we'll talk a lot about just the basic terminology and anatomy of the skin in that lecture. So if you're interested, tune in for that. But this is what we see in TEN. There's a blister. So this is your dermis. This is your epidermis. They're supposed to be attached to one another. All of this blue stuff here is inflammation. Those are lymphocytes. Not supposed to have any inflammation in the skin. So this is inflamed, and the epidermis is detached. The epidermis up here is totally pink, which is necrosis. So we've got necrosis and detachment of the epidermis. That's the basic pathology in TEN. Dr. Bologna mentioned some other causes of TEN-like eruptions. So one of those causes she mentioned was immunobullous diseases like linear IgA. So these are eruptions that can look all the world like TEN clinically, but they're not due to a drug. They are other causes. And linear IgA being one, graft versus host. So if a patient has acute graft versus host disease, that can look just like a morbilliform drug eruption. That can look just like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or just like TEN. If you think about it, it's actually kind of the same pathway. The lymphocytes or the immune system is inappropriately attacking your skin, not because of a drug in that case, but because of the lymphocytes being from another person, a host, and then you are recognized as foreign to them. So it's sort of the same pathway that converges. So graft versus host is a big differential for SJS or TEN. Pseudoporphyria, often caused by drugs like NSAIDs, and then lupus. Always got to think about acute cutaneous lupus as a mimic of TEN. A nice article was published about these differentials, and they proposed this terminology to kind of be an umbrella term for all the different things that can look like TEN. They call it ASAP. Acute syndrome of apoptotic panepidermolysis. that really hasn't taken on, but it is just a unifying concept. Like, the epidermis is dying, and it's due to one of these causes. How do you tell TEN from lupus? So what they share in common is that the epidermis, the full thickness of that top layer of your skin, totally dies and detaches. What's different is the triggers. So toxic epidermal necrolysis is due to drugs in lupus. In ACLE, the patients have systemic lupus, and this flare is usually caused by ultraviolet. So it's a patient who presents acutely having been exposed to light. In lupus, it's going to be a photo distribution. So there can be sparing where their clothes were, or if there was a unique kind of exposure photo distribution. In TEN, it's a more diffuse eruption. ACLE, not so much mucous membrane involvement and not so much palms and sole involvement. And then anytime we're thinking about lupus, we want to consider the autoantibody profile. Check that ANA. Look for the extractable nuclear antigens, the ENA panel. Look for those autoantibodies, which would not be positive in TEN. So why is TEN such a dreaded diagnosis in SJS? Why are these such dreaded diagnoses? They have a potential for death. And the most common cause of death is bacterial infection. The epidermis is a barrier that prevents bacteria and stuff in the outside world from getting inside of you, and it keeps what you want to keep inside, like the water, the electrolytes, the nutrients. So that barrier is super important for preventing infections. And if you necrose your epidermis and it sloughs off, you have lost that barrier and you are at risk for infection. And the most common organisms are staph and pseudomonas. We can calculate the risk that an individual patient, what's the chances that this patient will die from their TEN? You can calculate that risk based on clinical information and information you gain from a BMP, the basic metabolic panel. You don't have to order a bunch of fancy labs or anything. You can calculate this knowing the patient's age, whether or not they have a malignancy, how much surface area is detached, and what's their heart rate, and then some information from the basic metabolic panel, the BUN, the glucose, and the bicarb. And there's 7 criteria here. The sum total of the score is called the score 10, and this is the graph that tells you what their predicted survival is based on the score 10 score. So if your score 10 score is 0 to 1, meaning you met 0 or 1 of those criteria, let's say you're 18 years old, you've got no cancer, you've got a normal vital signs, your BMP is normal, and your body surface area is 8%, your score 10 score is 0. Your survival at 60 days with Stevens-Johnson syndrome is 0.94, so 94%. Really good. Let's say your score 10 score is greater than 5. You're 60 years old, you have been treated for breast cancer, your heart rate is through the roof, your metabolic panel is totally deranged, and you have 50% body surface area. You've got a score 10 score of 6 or 7. And your survival at 60 days is 0.17, 17%. So this prediction of your survival is basically based on these clinical factors, your history, and the vital signs and the basic metabolic panel. So this helps us decide who's, you know, going to be more at risk of dying from this TEN. So some of the complications, let's say that the patients survive, what complications or what predictors may indicate higher mortality? Renal failure is a bad finding. Septicemia, that's usually the main cause of death. If the patients have epilepsy, bacterial infection, or malignancy, these all induce higher risks of mortality. So what are some of the sequelae? This is where the patients are going to come back to see you. And the patients you may recognize they have Stevens-Johnson syndrome. They come to you with what looks kind of like a morbilliform eruption, pink papules, but they say skin pain. It feels like a sunburn. So you send them to the ER. They get admitted. They get treatments, which I'll show you in a second what treatments are. They make it. They survive. they come back to you. What do you do now? Obviously, you know, you're going to tell them, stop the drug, don't take whatever it was, don't take Bactrim ever again. But there's a lot of sequela that you can help them manage, and it has to do with the inflammatory consequences of Stevens-Johnson. So first of all, there's going to be some pigmentary changes, post-inflammatory pigmentary dyspigmentation. It doesn't scar. It doesn't lead to scars or keloids, but it does lead to dyspigmentation. Just like if the patient had a cancer treatment, for example, you can have nail and hair shedding, nail more common than hair. The patients may develop chronic pruritus and dry eyes or dry mouth. This is a big one, urethral adhesions. Think about all that inflammation on the surface of the genitals. That can lead to urethral adhesions, urinary retention, and urinary tract infections. So all of these patients should be co-managed by a urologist. Ocular is probably the biggest complication. Hopefully the patients will not have scarring conjunctivitis, but if they do, that can lead to blindness. So all patients with SJS or TEN need to be co-managed by urologists and ophthalmologists. So how do we as dermatologists manage SJS or TEN? First things first, and I should have probably put this as second on the list, but probably the first thing is rapidly withdraw the culprit drug. You really want to make sure that that's been done. It can be hard to determine what drug is the most likely. So the way that we categorize or prioritize what drug to tell a patient to stop has to do with the time frame. So I mentioned earlier 7 to 10 days. And then also our knowledge of the literature on the topic, which drugs are more likely. And so allopurinol, carbamazepine, phenytoin. Antibiotics like Bactrim, and then some of the penicillin antibiotics, and then certain NSAIDs. Those are the most common. So those, and then that, looking at that time frame, definitely within 8 weeks, but usually 7 to 10 days. So stop that drug. Calculate the score 10 score. If the score 10 score is greater than or equal to 1, all of these patients should be referred to the ER, to the local hospital. If they have a higher score 10 score, they may need to be transferred to a burn unit for that wound care, that intense wound care that they're going to need. Supportive care is very important. Supportive care means making sure that they're getting the fluids, the electrolytes, the nutrition, and pain control. Wound care, this gets a little bit more controversial, and we have conflicts all the time at our hospital between different services about, you know, should we debride the wounds, should we put certain dressings on. This is pretty controversial. The main concept here is trying to prevent infection. And you want to use gauze that is impregnated with petrolatum so that there's no dry gauze that kind of rips off new skin as it's formed. You really want to make sure that you're using petrolatum and non-adherent gauzes in these patients. Ocular care is very important in patients with SJS or TEN. All patients that are suspected of SJS or TEN should be examined by an ophthalmologist. Even if they don't have any apparent eye involvement, they need to use an eye lubricant. And think of that just kind of an analogous way to the way that we recommend a moisturizer for patients with something as simple as dry skin. Anytime that there's a redness of the conjunctiva, they're going to need that lubricant and possibly some topical steroids. And if the surface of the eye is at all affected, they get amniotic membrane transplants. These are amniotic membranes that a little piece is cut off of. It's sewed down onto the eyeball, and then they sew the eyelids shut. And so the eyes stay shut for like a week with this amniotic membrane on there. And it's meant to protect the surface and prevent it from becoming dry. As a dermatologist, we do play a role in the management of the SJS, and this is usually through immunomodulation. So do we need to treat the patients with something that suppresses the inflammation? All of these treatments here have been described and appear in the literature. Steroids, cyclosporin, IVIG, plasmapheresis, thalidomide, cyclophosphamide, TNF-alpha inhibitors, all of them have pluses and minuses, and some of them have really fallen out of favor. Steroids were the mainstay at the beginning of our understanding of SJS or TEN. And there's been some studies. They have conflicting results. The main risk is infection. So, you know, steroids, you reduce inflammation, but you, on the same token, you increase the risk of infection, which is the dreaded cause of death in these patients. So it has pretty much fallen out of favor and it is not recommended. So if you think somebody has SJS, don't attempt to start them on prednisone. It's not recommended. What we usually do, and this is kind of an emerging treatment that has a lot fewer side effects, is etanercept. So this is a good option. It can be just a single dose. It's 25 to 50 milligrams sub-Q twice weekly. Even after one single dose, we can start to see decreased inflammation in the skin. And there was a randomized controlled trial that showed that etanercept compared to prednisolone, which is kind of related to prednisone, was associated with a shorter time to healing. And so etanercept has shows also the decreased mortality. So this has emerged as a more palatable immunomodulator compared to steroids just due to better side effects. Cyclosporine is another option. It works very quickly. It inhibits T cells. Some conflicting data out there on the different studies, but it has been shown to reduce the risk. So this is the protocol we follow at UT Southwestern, and there's currently some studies that are underway, multi-center studies. So TEN, SJS, I mentioned earlier in the program that they're super rare, so like 2 per million per year. So getting good data on how to treat this has been a challenge. And so what's happening now is a consortium of hospitals are enrolling patients in a multi-center trial to look at these different agents and see really which one in a controlled way is the best treatment so that we can have more evidence and data to guide our decisions. So UT Southwestern is participating in that trial, but for now we're kind of left with individual preferences and experiences. And so this is the protocol at UT Southwestern. We use cyclosporine. Cyclosporine you may recognize as a treatment for patients with atopic dermatitis or psoriasis. The reason that we use cyclosporine in any of these skin diseases is that it works quickly. It has a really nice, quick onset. The reverse of that statement is it's not good in the long run. It's got a lot of side effects that we can't keep patients on it forever. So if you're thinking about a patient with terrible psoriasis, you want to get them started on a biologic, but they don't have insurance yet, or you can't start it yet, you can cool everything off with cyclosporine, but it causes hypertension, it causes electrolyte abnormalities, and so you can't keep them on it forever. Well, in these patients, we're not talking about a long-term treatment, so it's a little bit better from that standpoint. We begin treatment with cyclosporine, usually an IV dose. If they can swallow, we'll give them an oral dose. We try to do this before 7 days have passed. And we reserve it for patients that have more than 10% body surface area involvement. If we think they're infected, don't give it because it's an immunosuppressing drug. Their creatinine clearance has to be measured, and if the eGFR is less than 30 mils per minute, we don't do it. You can't give it to patients with hypertension, with the diastolic pressure greater than 110. We avoid an HIV and then monitor the follow-up. If the eGFR has decreased or if the blood pressure is increasing, we don't give this. And usually this is a course that's just a couple days long, like 3 or 4 days. It's not a prolonged course. So this is probably the best shot that we have right now at shortening the course of duration in SJS and preventing some of those extreme severe complications. But more information is going to be coming from these studies that are currently being enrolled. So we've got about 10 minutes left for any questions. I know maybe some from the virtual audience or anybody here in the audience that has questions about EM, SJS, TEN, how to manage, feel free to ask. I mentioned earlier in one of the other sessions that Friday afternoon is always when the zoster ophthalmicus patients come up, and it seems like SJS similar. I don't know what it is, but it seems like most of the patients with SJS we see on Friday afternoon or over the weekend. But hopefully this is something that you won't encounter frequently in your practice, but you'll be able to recognize and then refer to the appropriate treatment centers if you do encounter. So any questions? Okay, well, thanks for your attention, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.